The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Now, we'd planned to take an Olympic break, but this podcast has been recalled because Nick Clegg has turned 50 shades of grey as he announced an end to House of Lords reform. We ask, has the coalition romance all gone a bit sadomasochist? And who'll be doing the whipping when the crucial votes come around on boundary reform? Also this week, Boris turns superhero. London's mayor is on hand to claim credit for a successful Olympic Games. But is the capital's clown worth taking seriously as a new Tory leader? And as Louise Mensch resigns to spend more time with her family, really meaning it seems, we ask if MPs have an impossible job. Joining me for all of this, we have The Observer's Nick Cohen, the Lib Dem blogger Mark Pack, and down the line, our columnist and old friend Martin Kettle. A warm welcome to you all. Now, the rumours of its demise were not, it turns out, exaggerated. The House of Lords reform plan is, for the moment, and what could be a long moment, very much dead.
So, after a long process, almost 2.5 years, we do not have the Commons majority needed to ensure this bill progresses through Parliament. It is obvious that the bill's opponents would now seek to inflict on it a slow death, ensuring Lords reform consumes an unacceptable amount of parliamentary time. Clearly, it would be wrong for me to allow Parliament to be manipulated in this way, not least at a time when there is so much else for us to concentrate on. So I can confirm today that we do not intend to proceed with the bill in this Parliament, and the government will make a full statement on this to Parliament as soon as it returns in September.
Oh dear, Martin Kettle, he doesn't sound at all happy there, does he? But in your column today, you see something of a silver lining somewhere down the line for this defeat for progressive reform.
It's incredibly frustrating that Britain, you know, which is in so many ways casting off some of its sort of rather gloomier traditions, remains in hock to this system of an unelected second chamber and basically the corruption that is involved in the creation of it. And, you know, that system has fought off this latest attack, and that is news in the round. On the other hand, and, you know, it's a sort of fairly conditional and sort of subjunctive kind of on the other hand, I do think that this was never going to work. It was a doomed bill. It was always going to risk losing in the Commons and face, you know, immense problems in the Lords. And so, in a way, it's better that they've recognised the truth of the matter early on, rather than subject themselves and the public to the spectacle of Parliament navel-gazing and wrangling about its own powers at a time when I think, you know, British politicians desperately need to be seen to grasp the seriousness of the things that, you know, are facing the country and to be trying to do something about it. So, you know, I just think in the end, this is a long road to House of Lords reform. As everybody knows, it's been going on for more than a century, and it's just going to have to go on for a few more years yet. But I think in the circumstances, the way we stand now, it's probably the least worst outcome.
Mark, the rest of the country might be thinking about something else, and almost certainly is thinking about something else, but a lot of people in the Liberal Democrats saw this as the one big tangible thing that they could hope to get as a lasting legacy out of this coalition once the voting system change had gone. How big a blow is it for the party and its morale?
I've actually been quite surprised how well the party grassroots in particular have reacted to the news. I think in part because it's not been a huge surprise. You know, it's quite heavily trailed that this might happen. And very much the anger is directed at sort of David Cameron and Ed Miliband in terms of if either of them had really wanted Lords reform and been able to deliver their party's votes, it would have still gone ahead. So I think for a lot of Liberal Democrats, yes, there is great disappointment that Lords reform was not happening, but because a large part of the responsibility lies with other parties, actually the party is a happier party than it has been after some of the other, you know, previous high-profile controversies. And I think you're absolutely right. One of the big questions for the party is what its long-term legacy will be out of having been in coalition. And many of the other policies, very good though they are in themselves, like making the big steps towards £10,000 income tax allowance have a bit, you know, a bit more of a transient nature than constitutional reforms. You know, new governments come and go, tax levels, tax rates come and go.
Inflation can eat that kind of
exactly,
thing up.
Exactly, and
can't it?
Constitutional reform actually very often doesn't get undone. If you think, I mean, in a way, the Conservative Party's traditional attitude towards constitutional reform is to oppose every change that comes along, and then once it's implemented, to be massively in favour of keeping that and not making any moves to undo it. So constitutional reform is still important for Liberal Democrats. There's a bit that's been achieved, fixed-term parliaments, but you're absolutely right. There's a lot of Liberal Democrats will be looking to achieve something more, perhaps on party funding in the second half of this parliament.
Fixed-term parliaments, Nick, we're all still getting used to the rules, but does it feel to you, when we've now got the prospect of the thing that David Cameron most wanted out of the coalition agreement, this new political map that was going to make it easier for him to win a majority in the House of Commons, that now Nick Clegg is saying his ministers, not just his backbenchers, his ministers are going to be voting against. Do you think this show can stay on the road while that kind of thing's happening?
Well, if I could guess for a moment, spoil the unanimity and stop this podcast being a sort of liberal loving, which is grotesque thing that's even 50 Shades of Grey imagines. Look, fixed terms parliaments, one reason why laws reform failed was this preposterous notion that you elect a representative for 15 years, where democratic accountability just completely goes out of the window. The Tory backwoodsman had some good arguments against it. I do think it will go through in the end, because there is a counter-absurdity now. We have far more peers who, as Martin implied, are there because they've been loyal party hacks or they've given money to a political party, then we do elected MPs. That number is just going to go and grow. David Cameron's creating peers to get his give him a majority. If Ed Miliband gets in, he'll create more peers. We'll soon have, I mean, at the moment, we've got 2-1, 2 unelected legislators for every one elected. That's going to go to 3-1 quite soon. And it's just even the British are going to wake up to the absurdity of this and the insult of this, that you cannot, that legislators ought to have the condescension to appear before the electorate and secure a democratic mandate. As for the whole thing falling apart, I genuinely don't know. I mean, you know, you should always say in these things the future is unknowable, but I always thought that the Lib Dems would stay until the end because their poll rating's so bad and turkeys don't vote for Christmas. Mm. And then I thought, well, David Cameron will stay in the end because he's got to get boundary change through. Now, if he can't do that, however, where does that leave us?
And, Martin, with this new fixed-term parliaments Mark was talking about, I mean, it's like the system in Germany, I think. Three times since Second World War, Germans have forced an early election despite supposedly fixed-term parliaments. It's conceivable, isn't it?
I think it's conceivable, yeah, I do. And I think especially if the, if the coalition fell on a genuine matter of confidence, I think that would be would undoubtedly be the case if it had a piece of legislation which was absolutely fundamental to its existence. I personally don't think that the orders to implement the boundary changes constitute that. I think if the Tories are defeated on that, and that's still well over a year away because that vote isn't likely to take place before October 2013 at the earliest. If the Tories are defeated on that, I don't think it constitutes a government defeat in quite the same technical sense that it would if it was a budget or something of that sort, or a confidence motion. I think it's very interesting to look at the parliamentary arithmetic about this question at the moment because it's nail-bitingly close. I think it's just conceivable that the Conservatives, and I think this is why David Cameron has kept the issue in play this week, that the Conservatives think they could cobble together a majority without Liberal Democrat support on this issue when it comes to it.
So who else might help them out?
With all the small parties, and, you know, some of those small parties are always in the business of selling their votes in circumstances like this. Democratic Unionists in Northern Ireland, certainly. The SNP, I think, very interestingly, might put a price on its votes and be open for business there. So, you know, if you actually add it up at the moment, it's pretty close. I mean, assuming that Labour, we'll come onto this, but even assuming that Labour wins the Corbyn by-election, Labour and the Liberal Democrats together in October 2013 would have, I think, 312 MPs. Now, that's actually short of a majority. So those small parties will matter, and the Tories may think they can do a deal with them.
And you don't think there's going to be the odd Tory, though, who will also quite fancy keeping hold of their seat? Because as well as redrawing the map, they're just reducing the number of seats. Isn't there some self-interest there?
No, that's certainly possible. Though I think the Tories, on the whole, have handled the whole Boundary Commission innovation much more professionally and successfully than Labour have done. I think they've been very attentive to the kind of MPs you're talking about. Since obviously there are going to be Tory MPs who are going to be squeezed out of seats, I think you will find that, that Central Office is keen to help them to find other seats. And then, of course, there's our old friend, the House of Lords, always, which can solve quite a lot of problems of this sort.
They might have to, there'd be an irony there if they ride to the Liberal Democrat rescue on this one, Mark, which I suppose is conceivable. I mean, it'd be fairly hard to imagine, I'd have thought, after this, Nick Clegg surviving as leader, if he's lost House of Lords reform, then made this threat about the boundaries and the boundaries go through anyway.
That certainly would be very difficult territory. I mean, as Martin says, the maths is quite tight. And, you know, if you do a sort of Jeffrey Archer type, you know, political fiction sort of storytelling session, you can obviously come up with a sequence of events in which the maths falls that way. In reality, though, I think it's very, very hard to see that happening, partly because the risk for David Cameron of going, you know, of forcing a vote in the Commons on an issue that so many of his party feel so strongly about that he loses is quite a considerable one. And also for some of the minor parties, some of the smaller parties, such as from Wales, there is a very strong incentive to vote down the boundary changes because Wales loses a large number of seats. Now, I happen to think it's right that different parts of the country should be represented in proportion to their population. So I think it, you know, the number of seats in Wales should be brought into line per head with the number in England. But you can perfectly understand why Welsh politicians and particular would not, you know, vote that through. So I think it's really in the right at the nearly inconceivable end of the spectrum in terms of how you would end up with the Tories winning that boundary vote.
But all of this stuff, Nick, as suddenly the politicians who were at pains to push these things through a while ago, now they're sort of saying, oh, this is second order stuff. What we're really interested in is jobs and growth, although we don't seem to have much of either. Isn't the danger that politics now is going to be stuck with people having these arguments that are just really about naked self-interest?
Yeah, I mean, less so than if Lords reform had gone ahead and the House of Lords, in a rather trade union, Freemasonry kind of way, had fought to the end to defend its privileges. But yes, that is a danger. I was thinking when Martin was saying about he could see the coalition ending on a big question. And for me, the question is, when are the Liberal Democrats, or at least the left of the Liberal Democrat Party, the Social Democratic wing of the Liberal Democrat Party, if I may call it that, when are they going to start saying, I'm very, very sorry, but the economic strategy we embraced in 2010 has just not worked out at all and it needs to change? Because, you know, if you look at their assumptions, this is not a particularly part of the political point. I mean, Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling were as bad as this in 2008. They assumed that this was a standard recession, that, yeah, okay, we'll take the hit and then growth will come back. And with Clegg and Cameron and Osborne and Cable, it was the assumption that the private sector would somehow take up the slack. And it will happen. Now, none of this is working out. And you would have hoped that the sort of Vince Cable wing of the Liberal Democrats will start, you know, putting the country first, if you like, and start saying we have got to change policy.
Do you think that's possible?
And there's no sign of that yet, incidentally.
It's certainly possible. I think the big thing to look out for in the political agenda in that sense is the expected announcement in the autumn about much greater investment in housing and in social housing, both in terms of trying to deal with the housing problem, but also investment to boost economic growth. And whether we see a substantive package that is likely to have impact on economic growth or not, I think is the next key stage in that respect. It's worth perhaps mentioning that Lib Dem Voice has just done its latest survey of party members, and less than 1 in 10 blamed the current state of the economy on the coalition's economic policies, which is, I was quite surprised just how low that figure is.
It's,
And I think if that figure goes up over time, then I think...
Is that because, Mark, you know, I don't know if it was you or Martin mentioned the party's grassroots. Well, the grass is getting very bald as a lawn. You know, is that because you've lost so many members? The people who are likely to remain as Lib Dem members are small-C Conservatives.
Which is what we had in the Labour Party, I think, after the Iraq War. The leadership managed to prevail on a number of points because so many... of the awkward squad, if you like, had left. So do you think that's happening?
There's maybe a little bit of that as a factor, but when you've got less than 10% saying they blame the current government's economic policy, that is about, you know, a broad, widespread view across all sort of wings of the party in that sense. That, you know, I think is the figure that if it starts going up sharply is when the political dangers that Nick was talking about will kick in for the party. And, you know, as with, I think, both parts of the coalition, so much of people's political fortunes, as in, you know, when we have single-party government, rest on the state of the economy.
Tom, I think, can I just add one thing to that? I mean, I think in practice, in political practice, this is all down to Vince Cable. I mean, he is the only figure of credibility who could put himself forward as a new leader in these circumstances, I think, certainly within this parliament. I mean, he is therefore an absolutely crucial player. You occasionally get sort of hints and little smiles and nudges that suggest there is a sort of Cable project for leadership gathering in the wings somewhere. But I'll kind of believe it when I see it, really. If it's coming this autumn, which some people have hinted at, I don't really see much sign of it. I think in reality, Clegg is safe at the moment.
And certainly, I think the number of times Vince is in disagreement with other Liberal Democrat ministers in government over policies doesn't suggest that he's particularly looking to cultivate support from other figures in the party with that in mind at the moment.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that In a way, it's a broader question for the left, I think, that although there is huge, widespread and justified dissatisfaction with the economic situation, with the economic policy of the government, what is not so clear is what a politically sustainable alternative would consist of. And that extends to the Labour alternative as well as to any putative Vince Cable-led Liberal Democrat alternative.
Well, let's just swap horses here from one veiled leadership bid to another, or half bid, because if the Olympic Games have been a welcome distraction for the coalition, for Boris Johnson, they've been an opportunity to dance in front of the Olympic flame. I mean, he's been enjoying himself hugely. He manages to get stuck up a zip wire, Nick Cohen, and somehow turn this into a great triumph. And he's actually got crowds following him off, following him around wherever he goes. The kind of disavowals of
Boris, Boris.
The disavowals of interest are becoming increasingly craftily crafted. And now I hear he's down to address the 1922 committee of backbench Conservative MPs on how to win election.
Well, I mean, look, I have. Let's not dismiss him. You know, there are no other politicians. I mean, possibly Vince Cable, who are as popular as Boris Johnson. No one can get crowds chanting their names. He is the only Conservative to have won a major election since 1992. Conservatives are not very good at winning elections anymore. They couldn't even win against Gordon Brown in 2010. So, you know, they have problems in that respect. I genuinely don't know. The Mayor of London is an office you can get credit without taking responsibility for. You have very few powers. Limited powers over the police, some powers over transport, which is not particularly good in London. I just don't know that if he were put in a position of authority where he was held accountable for his actions, whether all the criticisms you can make of Johnson, that he is a manufactured buffoon. He's not actually a buffoon. This is all a great act he works very hard at. That he is hugely inconsistent, that he will switch from being... when he goes to speak to the 1922 committee, he will be a right-wing Tory. When he goes back to the mayor's office, he will be a liberal wanting amnesty for illegal immigrants, something that drives Tories absolutely wild. well, that happened. And also just the sheer disorganisation of any organisation he's in charge in. You can make it charming, you can make it Worcesterish, and you can pretend this is all very English, which is fine. And, you know, I would have liked to work at the Spectator when the wine and women were flowing, and I wouldn't have blamed him for it as editor. However, whether you want the same in the Prime Minister is another matter.
Do you think this is right, Martin? Do you think as this goes from being fantasy politics league kind of stuff to something that people are maybe looking at just a touch more seriously after the Olympics, that the idea will stop looking as attractive very quickly?
Well, I think, you know, there are three sources of this story, I think. One is the media, who like Boris because he's great copy. The second is Boris, who likes Boris and is an ambitious person. And the third is the right wing of the Tory party, which hates David Cameron and has worked itself up into an increasingly bizarrely self-confident view that what the country is crying out for is a more right wing conservative government than the one that it's got at the moment, for which there is zero evidence. But they look at Boris and they say, as Nick says, you know, he's a man who can win elections and win elections in what ought to be, other things being equal, Labour territory, and they think that he would be able to do this across the country. I just think that in the end, some of these pressures are going to propel Boris somehow or other into a national political role at some point in his career. I don't, on the whole, see it happening right now, because I think there are quite a lot of quite practical, boring things to be overcome. You know, he's been elected as mayor and has said that he will serve the full term. That rather constrains him. The other thing is, of course, he does have to find a seat. Now, that's not impossible, but depending on who really controls the party, it could be a pretty bloody affair. And although, as I said earlier in this podcast, you know, I think you know, a prime minister always has a possibility of moving people to the House of Lords or whatever to create a vacancy for somebody he wishes to promote. I'm not sure that I see David Cameron using up all that much political capital in providing Boris with a golden parachute back to Westminster and lead a coup against him. So it seems to me it may happen one day, and I think there are lots of things in our politics which mean that someone like Boris has got lots of potential, but I think that it's not very likely to happen this side of the general election.
Mark, the second blonde bombshell of the week is Louise Mensch saying that she's going to walk away from politics altogether. I mean, there's an opening, I suppose, in theory in Corby, but it would be in decent haste, wouldn't it, for Boris to
yes, and
step down as mayor already.
Pretty firmly ruled out going for Corby. I think
it's a very marginal seat as well.
And, yeah,
I mean, he might not win. I mean, that will just be the end of him if you say, oh, my great comeback into Parliament, and you fight and lose.
Exactly, because as you say, Nick, you know, Boris's great strengths are his persona, but combined with an election-winning ability. And in a way, he slightly reminds me of Silvio Berlusconi in that respect. You know, the wine and the women and all of that.
I was thinking that this morning.
And, I mean, imagine what a Boris-owned London TV station would be like. So, but thankfully, the parallels don't go quite so far.
I don't think we have to imagine. If you turn on the telly every night and he's kind of there sort of doing some weird action hero thing with a grateful crowd.
Yeah. I know columnists shouldn't say this, but I think I've written this column once.
Have you? Are you sure there, Martin?
Boris Johnson is the nearest thing we've got to a British Berlusconi. So I agree. I mean, I think he's very tantalising in that respect, in shaking up politics in this more populist way. But, you know, as you say, I mean, if he ran in Corby, he'd be taking a hell of a risk. I mean, if he won Corby, he could maybe say, well, this proves something. But if he loses, well, then what happens? And, you know, I think Labour will win Corby.
And I mean, it's just too soon, isn't it? I mean, it's such a big thing to win as mayor of London. And then if you look like you don't want the job of 3 or 4 months in, it's surely, Marcus.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if Boris's game plan is to want to succeed David Cameron, in a way, he wants to be disassociated from the government for as long as possible. And, you know, if Boris were to get elected in some parliamentary by-election this year, actually the meanest thing that David Cameron could do is offer Boris a relatively junior role in government. And Boris either then gets shackled with being in government and with all of the flack that comes with it, or, you know, he has to put his cards on the table and say, no, I'm going to be disloyal. I don't want to help serve my party. So from Boris's point of view, you know, the ideal is obviously a by-election just before the next election. You can't absolutely pick the ideal, but I'm sure if he could pick, you know, the perfect plan, that would be it.
So we'll watch this space for a bit on Boris. And just on Mensch, Nick, you know, it seems genuine this time. I want to spend more time with my family, actually stepping down as an MP. Everyone was busily writing things about her wanting to be the next Mrs. Thatcher. Were you surprised? And do you think we should feel sorry for MPs?
I like her, and she adds some glamour and some commitment to politics. She's always on the social media, always arguing the Tory case. I don't agree with her, but you know, you want people like that. Look, being an MP is a relatively hard job, but in this case, I don't think it's the normal argument you have about how unfriendly Westminster is to women. I don't think it is that unfriendly anymore. Used to be. But it does show that if you, the fault in this, it seems to me, lies with her husband, in that her husband is managing a quite mediocre rock group in New York. He's not back supporting her. And if you've got a family where one partner's in one continent and another partner's in another continent, and they both want to do high power jobs, something normally gives. And it's interesting that her husband's not prepared to come back to Britain and support her.
That's certainly what surprised me about the story, was there didn't seem to be any, you know, possibility that it might be that the husband, you know, gives up his immediate career.
I do notice, Mark, all the criticism, certainly in the right-wing press, was of her, oh, she took this job on, none of the husband.
So, no, exactly.
And I would have thought, well, you can manage a rock band from London as well as you can from New York.
I think we'd better leave a fuller discussion of whether women are in special pressure in politics to today, where we've got some women on the panel. So let's leave that there for now. My thanks to Nick Cohen, to Mark Pack, and to Martin Kettle. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much indeed for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.